Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silica Cast podcast, hosted at podfeed.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias, a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Today is Sunday, March 19th, 2006, and this is show number 35. Well, all of you who scoffed at the fact that I was washing my car last weekend, even though it was supposed to rain in 2 days, I'll have you know it did not rain all week, so my car was pretty clean. Well, actually, I lied. It rained on Friday, but that's okay, because I got to wash it again on Sunday. So remember I asked how many countries there actually are? Well, we now have 93 countries listening or reading to the No Silica Cast, and no new ones this week. So we don't have Antarctica yet, so I think there's still a few stragglers out there. I'm so glad you're all here, though. Now that the new country update is slowing down, I think I'll do a new featured country of the week. I looked at the bandwidth used by each country, and I noticed a surprising thing. The fourth place country in terms of downloads is actually Estonia. I headed on over to answers.com to check out Estonia and to see if I could find a clue as to why there's so many of you listening from Estonia. I found the section describing your industries, and it said engineering, electronics, wood and wood products, textile, information technology, and telecommunications. You sure sound like my kind of people. Estonia is a country of North Central Europe, west of Russia, bordering on the Baltic Sea, and gained their independence in 1991. It sounds like a beautiful country with numerous lakes and more than 800 islands off the coast. Estonians, who are ethnically and linguistically close to the Finns, make up about 65% of the population. Russians constitute almost 30%, and there are Ukrainian, Belarusian, and Finnish minorities. Estonian is the official language, but Russian, Latvian, and Lithuanian are also spoken. There must be some English-speaking folks there, too, or else you'd just like the sound of my voice. I doubt that. But I'm so glad you're listening. I'd love to hear from you in an email and hear about how technology features in your lives in Estonia. Drop me a line at allison@podfeet.com. I'd love to hear from you. For some listener feedback, last week I asked if anyone knew how to change what RSS feeds showed up in the pretty Apple screensaver. And listener Ian from California in the United States wrote in with a solution. He said that to change it, all you do is go to the desktop and screensaver preferences, and when you have the RSS screensaver selected, click on the Options button. A drop-down list will show you all the feeds that are pre-selected. He thought there is a thing in there where you can even put your own feeds in, like from my own site on podfeet.com. At first, I wasn't able to find that, but keep listening. He got me able to get back to Slashdot, which was the one I wanted to listen to, or have on my screensaver, I should say. And I also noticed that I could have chosen Adam Christensen's The Maccast, which is very cool. Now, there's something else coming about that, too. The reason Ian was able to figure this out is that he's only 13 years old, and so his brain hasn't atrophied like mine. He still clearly knows how to look around and explore and push buttons. I couldn't see that Options button to save my soul before he pointed it out. And he's clearly brilliant, as he says he loves the show. Listener Robert from Green Bay, Wisconsin, in the United States, took it up a notch and showed me how to get new RSS feeds into the list for the screensaver. If you bookmark the RSS feed in Safari, it will then show up in the list of feeds in the screensaver. You can test this now by going to podfeet.com, click on the blue RSS logo that shows up in the URL in Safari, and when the RSS shows on screen, bookmark it. You'll probably all have podfeet.com set as your homepage, of course, but just in case, bookmark it now. Then again, open up the RSS screensaver and click Options, and you should see the No Silica Cast RSS. That's how I could get it in myself, and Ian knew that, but I had to learn it from listener Robert there. The RSS screensaver issue was a real team effort because then Paul from Peru answered the third question, which was my curiosity of what happened to the numbers below the feeds as they go by. The screensaver used to show one entry at a time with a number below it, and if you pushed that number on your keyboard, it would get rid of the screensaver and open the RSS link in your browser to that very item. It was kind of cool because you could sit and watch Slashdot go by and say, "Ooh, I want to read that part," and you click the number and it would expand it for you. Somewhere along the line, though, those numbers simply disappeared, and I figured it was a software update that removed them, which kind of took a lot of functionality away. But Paul cracked the code on this one for me. It turns out that if you have a password set to wake on sleep or from the screensaver, the numbers disappear. I don't know how he figured this out, but the mysteries are all solved now. I've been having a heck of a time with my MacBook Pro this week. I discovered a problem with CD burning. Well, I got to kind of back into why I have a problem with CD burning, and then I'll tell you what happens to the MacBook Pro. I listen to podcasts in two different ways. I like to listen on my iPod Nano using the lanyard headphones while I'm doing chores like washing and waxing my car. You know how obsessive I am about that. And when I'm jogging on the beach. In my car, though, it's a little tricky. I've tried the tape adapters, and while the sound is muffled and nasty, I'd still use it since it's just people talking, but for some reason I wear out the tape adapters really quickly. Even the ones from Monster, the overpriced ones, start clicking after a short while. I mean like a month. I've burned through three of them so far, and two low-end, really nasty-sounding adapters as well. I also hate having all the wires laying around and my iPod doesn't get charged in this method. So next I tried the FM transmitter idea. This is a lot better. I bought the Belkin TuneBase FM from Crutchfield for $80, which is pretty cool. It plugs into the cigarette adapter with a flexible post bringing it up enough to be readable by the driver. It can be bent around in different directions, which was critical for me because there's only about an inch between the cigarette adapter and the gear shift. I had tried all these other different ones, like from DLO, and they were all too big. They stuck out too far, and I couldn't shift gears. The Belkin TuneBase does charge the Nano while I drive, which is cool, but the buttons are a little hard to push. I've gotten the hang of it, but I have to use my fingernail to push them. These are the buttons that allow you to change between four different presets, preset radio stations. There's also kind of a long lag until the sound switches channels. And another annoying feature is that if I have the Nano plugged in and I don't intend on playing it, I just want it to charge, it keeps turning back on every time I start the car or look at it funny. It just seems to turn itself back on. I'll turn it off and I look over and it's back on again. But I can still live with that. The biggest drawback, though, is that I live in Los Angeles and there are literally no empty frequencies. In certain areas, it's not too bad, but frequently I can hear the hiss over the sound. I've learned to live with it, and it's certainly a better solution than the other path. But the third solution is to burn the podcast to CDs. This would sound wasteful, but luckily my friend Namdar loves to get them from me, and he passes them off to his brother out of town after he's done listening, so they do get a lot of use. It's a hassle to burn them, but I do a whole slew of Leo Laporte's KFI radio show about once a month, and then whatever twit podcasts I've missed, and then I've got entertainment for a long time. The sound quality is certainly the best of all the options. It's a great solution, that is, if your computer will agree to burn CDs. I spent about 4 days diagnosing on my own why I couldn't burn audio CDs, and just under 2 hours on the phone with AppleCare. And the pattern we were able to find was that I can burn data CDs, but when I try to burn audio CDs, I can only burn one and then not a second one. This is in iTunes, by the way. So I bring up iTunes, burn an audio CD. I tell it to burn the next one. And it says, nope, not going to do it. And so I quit iTunes, open iTunes back up, tell it to burn, and it'll burn another one. It's very odd behavior. I did get some cool error messages, though. I got kind of the normal ones. For some reason, it gives me all different ones. I got the one that said it's a media problem, but the best one was the one that said, I cannot calibrate the laser power. Oh, great. So anyway, I had to take my poor little MacBook Pro back into Apple today, and they're going to send it back. This gave me the first opportunity to see how hard it is to move an identity from one Mac to another. As you might recall, I used the Migration Assistant to move everything on my computer from my old one to my new one, but I had never tried just moving one identity. It's actually quite easy, if you do it right. I started by just dragging the user from the MacBook Pro back to the PowerBook, taking the whole user directory. And that took about an hour because I've got about a 50 gigabyte directory. All right. I happen to keep every single photograph I've ever taken online, and I've had a digital camera just about as long as anybody. So it's kind of a lot of photos. But anyway, of course, this didn't work, and I knew that before I started. I just forgot to do it the right way. When I tried to open up that user, it just didn't work. It wasn't an identity. It was just kind of like a folder with a junk. So what you really have to do is the same steps I did the first time, which is you set the MacBook Pro up as a target disk using a FireWire cable back to the PowerBook. To set the MacBook Pro into target disk mode, you simply reboot while holding down the T key. And when you connect the two computers using a FireWire cable, it'll show up as an external disk. Now is the easy part that I forgot to do the first time. The right path is to open the Migration Assistant, which is an application in the Utilities folder. In there, they give you the option of moving a user. So simply clicking that option and waiting another hour for my old computer to get all the data over again, my old computer was up and running with my new user account, my old user account set up. Oddly, there's three things that don't translate well and didn't translate well when I converted over to the MacBook Pro a couple of weeks ago either. My screensaver wasn't on the right setting, which was odd. I had to re-enter my Snaps Pro registration ID, and the Microsoft Framework Library is horked up. Basically, whenever I open Excel, it'll say the Microsoft Framework Library is horked up or something like that. Anyway, last time I had to download a small file from Microsoft and that fixed it right up, so I'll have to do that again. But I think it's odd that Microsoft applications had a problem with this migration since I didn't migrate the applications, I only moved my user files. Very curious. Well, I guess there's library files in there. Maybe it was one of those things. Well, it is kind of sad to see the MacBook Pro go back to the factory. Things never seem to be the same when you get them back. You know, the latch doesn't close right, or there's a smudge where there wasn't a smudge before. I guess I shouldn't complain since my fallback machine is a perfectly functioning G4 PowerBook, right? What's kind of sad is I don't really notice it going that much slower than the MacBook Pro. A few things here and there, but that's another piece of evidence that maybe you want to hold off on shelling out the big bucks for a MacBook Pro anytime soon. Well, those crazy people at Google have done it again. They've actually mapped Mars. Go to google.com/Mars and check this out. This is so cool. There are three different map views. The default is the elevation map, which shows the highest mountain peaks in a light gray, that's at 21 kilometers. Pink is for lower elevations, say at around 3 kilometers. And as you go below sea level, it turns into a dark purple. I wonder how they decided what sea level was if there's no water. They just kind of picked something and called that zero? I don't get it. But in any case, it makes for a nice kind of psychedelic look to the whole thing. It's kind of pretty, actually. There's two other views you can select. One is the infrared view, and one is using visible light. The visible light one is kind of boring after looking at the elevation map because it's all just kind of in shades of gray. The infrared view is confusing because it doesn't look like any of the other views at all. I can't even recognize the same features. And it has these stripes through it where it looks like they didn't get any data, so it's not as good. So far, I've just described the view you can look at, but it actually works just like Google Maps. You can drag the topographical map around with your cursor to pan, and you can zoom in and out to investigate craters and canyons close up. Across the top, near the Google Mars logo, there are 9 different categories of features you can have identified. Sort of like the way they do Google Local, where you can ask for pizza places near your house, and it shows little flags for each location on the map with a letter in the flag, and then it lists the pizza parlors down the left with more information for you, like the address and phone number. With these 9 categories, you can select mountains, for example, and these little red and green flags spring up on each mountain, and down the side they have the names of the mountain and a link to the mission and system that discovered it, and the date it was mapped. For example, the Arcia Mons Mosaic was mapped on June 13, 2005 by the Thermal Emission Imaging Systems, or THEMIS. I don't quite know why some of them were red flags and some of them were green flags. Not quite sure about that yet. I'll leave you to do some discovery on canyons, dunes, plains, ridges, and craters, which are some of the other choices, but the coolest feature was that you can select spacecraft to be mapped. This is so awesome. You can see where each USSR, United Kingdom, and US spacecraft landed on Mars. We've actually landed on Mars 10 times, 6 of which were actually successful. If you click on a spacecraft, the flag showing the location pops up with a balloon with a little snippet of information. And if you click on the photo in the balloon, it'll take you to a website telling you about that particular spacecraft. The most amazing discovery for me in looking at this was realizing that the first successful landing on Mars was the Mars 3 lander from the USSR in 1971. That means we landed on Mars 35 years ago. I must have been napping. It sure doesn't seem like it was that long ago to me. I would have said like late 80s, early 90s, something like that. Really not paying attention, and I love this stuff. So, all right, the Mars 3 lander did only transmit a signal for 20 seconds after landing, but it's still pretty amazing. I'm always shocked at what great dreams humans have and how we can even think that we could pull off something like land on the moon. It simply astonishes me. You know, I think about that when I look at huge buildings or these gigantic bridges. You know, what would make us think we could do that? That's just crazy. Of course, I still have doubts that airplanes can really fly. I mean, I look at them and go, I don't get it. Anyway, go on over to check out google.com/Mars and do some Mars exploring on your own. Oh, I should warn you, you can't actually see all of Mars. Apparently, we've decided to only land in a certain area, and I'd like to know why that is, too. We seem to have been in a pretty small geographical area, but it's awfully cool. Well, it's time for another installment of the Weird and Wacky website. My buddy Ron brought us this week's featured site, designed to keep you informed of an important upcoming holiday. That's Talk Like a Pirate Day. This important date is Tuesday, September 19th, and TalkLikeAPirateDay.com will help you prepare for this important event. At TalkLikeAPirateDay.com, you can learn the top 26 things to say at the office during Pirate Day, like, hop to it, dogs, there'll be leftover catering booty in the break room for plundering. It's also important to pick your pirate name well in advance. You don't want to wait till all the good monikers are taken, do you? Luckily, the good folks over at TalkLikeAPirateDay.com have created a pirate name generator to assist you. They clearly put a lot of important work into this effort. After you have your pirate name selected, they even give you HTML code to paste into your blog to show your friends how cool your name is. By the way, my pirate name is Dread Pirate Bonnie. Hurry on over to TalkLikeAPirateDay.com and get prepared. The Z machine running at Sandia National Labs created a plasma that was unexpectedly hot. This plasma reached a temperature in excess of 2 billion Kelvin, making it arguably the hottest human-made thing ever in the history of the Earth, and for a brief time, hotter than the interior of stars. The Z machine experiment purposely creates high temperatures by focusing 20 million amps of electricity into a small region further confined by a magnetic field. During the unexpected powerful contained explosion, the Z machine released about 80 times the world's entire electrical power usage for a brief fraction of a second. You've got to check out the picture at the link in the show notes. This definitely looks like something out of Star Trek. What was not clear to me is why they're doing this and why it was an unexpected explosion. Not quite sure. Makes me a little nervous, but go check it out. I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but the Intel-based Macs don't naturally run Windows out of the box. It seems kind of like a natural thing that they would, since they're Intel-based machines, but the Intel chip they're using uses something called EFI instead of BIOS. I have a vague understanding what those two terms mean, but I'm not going to try, because I would either A, confuse those who don't care, and probably B, irritate those who do understand. So we'll just skip over what the difference is, but trust me, there's a massive and important difference. The exciting thing, though, is that some folks put up a site offering a reward to anyone who can figure out how to make Windows work on the Intel-based Macs. The guys that did it put up $100, and then they took donations from people to see if they could get a lot of excitement about it. Well, the reward got up to $13,854 this week, and some guys at onmac.net figured out how to do it. They've written some great instructions and packaged it up nicely, so even a goob like me could probably do it. What this will allow a user to do is what's called dual boot. That means when you first boot it up, it will ask which operating system you want to run. At that point, you can pick the Mac operating system or Windows. I'm probably going to let my friend Ryan do it to my MacBook Pro when I get back, just for the sheer geek factor of saying that we did it. That'll just be so cool. He does have to let me watch, though. That way I'll learn how to do it myself. This is pretty cool, but not what we all really want. What a lot of us are hoping for is the ability to run both operating systems simultaneously so we can flip back and forth whenever we need something only the other operating system can do. There's a technology called VMware, which means you create what's called a virtual machine in one machine inside the other one. This is sort of like virtual PC, but it's not from Microsoft. The guys are working on it, evidently, but haven't figured it out yet. I'm confident that the brains of the world will crack the code on this and make it work. That's really going to be fun. Some people have referred to putting Windows on a Mac as an abomination, but I think it would be the best of both worlds to be able to have both. I mean, imagine that you're sitting there working away on one operating system and a virus breaks out for it. Let's even say it's a Mac virus on the Mac side. That can happen. We know that. So what if you could just go, forget that operating system for a while. I'm going to switch over and run Windows now, or vice versa. I mean, that would really be an advantage, I think. Just be able to flip back and forth. You just scrape off the old one, put on another one, you keep going. That'd really be fun. Now, I will still whine and moan about how silly Windows is and how many times you have to click OK, but it could be a real time savings instead of having to reboot to complain about the operating system. By the way, when I was taking my MacBook Pro in, I asked the guy at the Genius Bar about, didn't he think it was cool that they'd figured out how to run Windows on the Mac? And he freaked out. He was going, la, 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 with his hands over his ear saying, I can't hear you. And he just said he didn't want to hear about it. And I asked him why he was freaking out. And he said, because it's going to void your warranty. I think he's all wet because both Steve Jobs and Phil Schiller of Apple have been quoted of saying more than once, saying that they would do nothing to preclude us from running Windows on the Intel-based Macs. I've chatted with my better informed buddies, and they said it is possible that the installation could have some effect on firmware, which could actually cause hardware problems. So there might be some basis but what he's saying, but I'm pretty sure this guy didn't really know what he was talking about. There's a great video out there. My buddy Ron tipped me off to a fantastic video on Google Videos. It's a spoof of how Microsoft would have designed the iPod packaging if it were up to them. It starts off by showing you the stark black and white iPod box, a simple logo and stylistic side view of the sleek, thin iPod, and a guy reclining, evidently listening to music. They show all six sides of the box, and then they show people writing notes on the screen about what's wrong with it. Like, well, we have to include something to show the included operating systems that are supported. And suddenly there's this big, ugly list down the side. And then it says, well, we need product advertisers on there. And a big, ugly, multicolored sticker goes on it. Anyway, this goes on and on and on until when you're done, it looks just like any kind of Microsoft box. But it's just so absolutely on point. It's fantastic. Check out the links in the show notes. It's a really long one, but I've put in a link. It's on video.google.com. Well, it's time for me to eat crow, I'm afraid. My friend Michael claimed that when I create a new podcast episode, I don't have to add the photo to the album art in order for you to see it in your podcatching client. He said there wasn't a tag for each episode or item in XML words for the image, only at the top level feed. I told him he was all wet that I had to upload my picture each time to each episode. But unfortunately, he proved to me that after all that extra work I've been doing, he showed me my own feed, and there was no reference to the image except at the top level for the feed. I hate it when I'm wrong, but I promised Mike that I would confess publicly that I was wrong and he was right. Fine, I did it, Michael. Are you happy? Well, on that note of contrition, I think it's time to wind up the show. As always, feedback is very welcome at Allison@podfeet.com. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.